Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How free is the World Wide Web, and how safe are the citizens who use it to communicate? As we continue to marvel at the remarkable ability of the Internet to spread ideas and information, my guest today would remind us that governments and corporations are often in a better position to wield power online than even well-organized civilians. And recent headlines from China to Egypt to Great Britain should serve as a reminder that we cannot assume we are entirely safe from surveillance or free to say and do whatever we choose online. Rebecca McKinnon is Schwartz Senior Fellow for Global Internet Policy at the New America Foundation and former CNN Bureau Chief in Tokyo and Beijing. Her new book is called Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. Rebecca, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much.
You want to remind us that we need to think of ourselves not simply as consumers of Internet information and communications platforms and products online, but as citizens who are expressing our rights to speech and to information. How does that distinction change the way we behave online?
Yeah, well, it's sort of like, you know, in your community, if you do nothing to ensure that your rights are protected and that your interests are looked after, you know, those who are most active in shaping that community may not really pay much attention to your rights. And it's the same thing online, that, you know, the Internet, what you can and cannot do with it today is not a fixed thing. It changes constantly. And so governments and companies and everybody who uses the Internet is shaping the way it works. So you have companies making decisions about how the software should work online, engineers making decisions about what you can and cannot do with the technology, regulators deciding what you can and cannot do. And so the point is that increasingly, you know, we're relying on Internet platforms, mobile technology for all aspects of our lives, right? Not just our love lives and our schooling and our jobs, but also our politics increasingly rely on these digital platforms that are largely owned and operated by the private sector and then regulated by varying degrees by governments. And so if we want to make sure that these digital spaces and platforms that we have come to rely on are shaped in such a way and regulated or not in such a way that our rights and fundamental liberties are protected and respected, we need to fight for that. We need to work for that the same way we fight and work for our rights in the offline world.
A few minutes ago, you said government and companies in the same breath. And the standard way to frame a discussion like this might be to first look at government infringements on civil liberties online and then to look at how corporations might use and share personal information. But it turns out they work together more than most people might realize.
Yeah, well, that's very true, you know, and we're all very concerned, of course, about how a lot of companies are collecting our information, what they're tracking, who they're selling it to, and so on. But the government also has increasingly access to that information and is seeking greater access. I mean, there was a big story that came out just on Sunday. The American Civil Liberties Union did a whole series of investigations on the way in which police departments are collecting information from our phones and finding a lot of the times that the information is being requested without any kind of legal due process in kind of bulk batches, which ends up sucking up information of people who are not under any kind of investigation. There's a couple of cybersecurity bills in Congress right now, which, you know, are meant to address some serious problems about, you know, the attacks against our networks, but would enable the government to share information with companies and companies to share information with government without a lot of checks and balances to make sure that this information is not abused by law enforcement and other agencies. So, you know, what we need to really make sure is not only that companies are behaving in a responsible and accountable way, but also that governments, when they're interacting with companies and using their power over companies to do things sometimes we want them to do, like law enforcement, are not abusing that power.
And a repressive government doesn't necessarily even need the intellectual capital to develop its own filters and censoring software. It can simply contract out to private corporations that have years of experience doing just this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right. And when I have a chapter in my book about China and how really the Chinese government outsources a great deal of the censorship and surveillance that go on in that country to the private sector. And a lot of it's done by Chinese companies as well, in that some of the major platforms like Facebook and YouTube and Twitter are all blocked in China. China has allowed local companies to develop similar services, and those companies are expected by the government to take down content the government deems to be objectionable, and also to hand over user information and help monitor users the government is concerned about. And so the private sector ends up acting as an extension of state power. You also have a situation where and a number of human rights groups and activists have discovered that all across the Middle East and North Africa, in a lot of the countries where you've seen people trying to use technology to protest against their governments and in some case bring down their governments, that these regimes are buying censorship and surveillance technology from Western companies, including American companies.
Just this week, Rebecca, we're hearing reports about China's crackdown on dissident bloggers. What are the most important takeaways for you from that story specifically?
Well, one of the really interesting things about that story is the extent, again, to which the government is holding the private sector responsible for that crackdown. Mm-hmm. So they did go ahead and arrest a number of people, but even more so, they went and intimidated the companies. They shut down a number of internet companies and then put a couple of the biggest internet companies on notice that if they didn't do a better job of controlling what their users were doing, they were going to face consequences. And then relying on the companies then to figure out how they were going to, implement tighter controls.
So clearly, in addition to everything else, there's a chilling effect. Every company thinks, let me just think ahead to what the government will expect me to do.
That's right. And what you get in situations like that is companies overcompensating. So they actually go above and beyond what the government may actually require them to take down or to monitor just proactively and protectively to keep themselves out of trouble.
Talk about this, though. On the other hand, you lived in China and you have experienced its censorship policies firsthand and how they work and when they don't work. What are the limits to its ability to police and to restrict what citizens can do online?
Yeah, well, there are definitely limits. And so, if you're sitting on a computer connection in Shanghai or Beijing or somewhere else in China, and you go online and you try and access, let's say, Facebook, you'll get an error message on your browser just saying this page cannot be found. Now, there are technical ways to get around that, what's known as filtering, or people like to call it the Great Firewall of China. And if you know how to use certain software or something called a virtual private network or what's called a proxy server that helps you basically tricks your internet connection into thinking you're going to some other site, but then you're going on to a site that they meant to block. So there are ways to get around that censorship, although it turns out most Chinese internet users are not using those technical tools to get around the censorship. But it's not foolproof, and so people who really want to access blocked sites do find a technical way to do it. And then the second layer of censorship is, as I described, you have all the Chinese companies, the Chinese social networking companies, the Chinese search engines. They're constantly deleting things that people are posting. And so people get very clever about kind of using images instead of words to talk about what they want to talk about, or using kind of jokes and puns and homonyms and literary allusions to talk about what they're going to talk about without saying it directly. And also, the government and the companies don't manage to control everything all the time. I mean, you've got 500 million internet users. So people do actually manage to have a lot more lively conversations than they did, through other media 10, 20 years ago in China. So they are feeling freer. You are able to use microblogs in China to call attention to a lot of problems. Sometimes local officials get fired because people expose their bad behavior online and all this kind of thing. So people do feel freer to talk about a lot more things and actually somewhat more empowered to bring about change when they see problems. But when people try to use the internet to actually organize, particularly at a national level, so if you try to use the internet to organize an opposition party, for mm-hmm. instance, or you try to use the internet to call for multi-party democracy or to call for a change in the top leadership, that content will go down immediately, and the people responsible for it will hear from the police.
So it almost sounds like China is in a sort of canny way, letting a little bit of it slide to bolster its own credibility, but cracking down immediately on what it truly finds threatening.
Yeah, that's right. And so it's the government, in a way, is using the internet to bolster its legitimacy and its credibility and to allow people to let off steam, to use it kind of as a focus group to find out where the problems are so that they can be addressed. So it actually helps the government in some ways improve local governance, especially without having to change the political system.
You also write about a phenomenon you call digital Bonapartism, which I gather is the sort of propaganda use of the internet by governments. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, basically, that's using the internet in a really populist way and saying, you know, we are really democratic because we're letting people speak online and so on, yet actually being fairly dictatorial. And so you see that, for instance, with Putin's Russia, for instance, where they don't actually directly censor the internet, but you have a lot of manipulation and then a lot of outright intimidation of, you know, there are enough bloggers and journalists who've been beaten up and thrown in ditches and even killed that you know, people kind of know where the limits are, yet at the same time you have the politicians and the leaders saying, no, we're actually really populist and kind of using the technology to gather support online.
Are they also sort of planting, comments saying, way to go, Putin regime?
Yeah, well, you definitely get that. You get that in China, too. And, mm-hmm. you know, here in the U.S., we call it astroturfing, and it's something that marketers do a lot, you know, when there's a product that you're trying to, you know, get positive buzz out about, you know, you'll have your employees go onto all the forums, you know, dealing with that kind of product and talk it up. And so politicians of all kinds do that too, and government officials do it all around the world, and they're doing it in China and Russia and elsewhere. And so, yeah, you'll have actual people whose job it is to, hang out online and talk up the government.
Because of the ongoing tornado emergency in the North Texas area, we are going to say goodbye this afternoon to our very qualified guest, Rebecca McKinnon, author of Consent of the Network. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellani answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about Think, find out about our upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Any comments, questions, or suggestions, you can either email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.